In this episode, I'm speaking again with good friend, neurosurgical registrar and carnivore educator, Dr. Anthony Chafee. We dive into a range of fascinating topics, including the ancestral human diet, the natural state of the health of humans based on best historical evidence, and why this is so important for medicine and health optimization today. We end with a deep dive on the real underlying factors driving atherosclerosis and atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. If you want to hear Anthony, I, and a list of fantastic speakers live in person, then we are hosting a event called Regenerate Melbourne on the 21st of April in Melbourne, Australia. This is going to be a fantastic day and a fantastic opportunity to connect with us. A final reminder that none of this is medical advice and to always consult with your treating clinician before making medication changes or embarking on low carbon carnivore if you are taking medications. Thank you, and now onto the show. Dr. Anthony Chafee, welcome back to the Regenerative Health Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to see you.
So maybe we could start with your just broad thoughts about where things went wrong. And if we wind the clock back, you know, 100,000 years, 10,000 years, what was the norm then that we've kind of butchered so far or got wrong to lead in part to people being so sick?
Well, if you go back 10, 20,000 years, 30,000 years, 100,000 years, a million years, 2 million years, the best evidence shows that humans have been apex predators for around 2 million years, maybe 2.5 million years. And before that, we were opportunistic meat eaters and eating more and more meat as we could find it. And we developed tools, stone tools for this effect. We didn't have the claws and the teeth that we could rip and render animals apart. So we needed to get sharpened tools to cut and dismember animals that we found or were able to opportunistically kill. And before that, and so that was about 3.3 million years ago with Australopithecus, first sharpened stone tool. So this was something that our ancestors have been doing for a very, very long time before the first true human, which is often considered to be Homo habilis about 2.5 million years ago, who then became apex predators and became able to take down large prey and not have to scavenge. Before Australopithecus, there's evidence going back a few million years of our early ancestors using large stones as pound stones to crack open the skulls of animals and get the brains, which are very, very nutritious, very high in fats and nutrients, fat-soluble nutrients, and obviously the different sorts of specific fatty acids that we need to grow and develop our brain and nervous system. I remember reading an article talking about how, like, well, how could we have grown this big brain? We need all these different nutrients. We need to eat all this thing, and all this plant and this plant and this thing and that fish and this thing and all these sorts of things. And I remember thinking at the time, well, why couldn't we just eat brains? I mean, that's going to have everything that we need by definition. And in fact, that's exactly what it turns out that we were doing for millions of years. We were eating the brains of other animals. We were eating the meat of other animals later on when it became accessible. And that continued on for about 2 million years until the end of the last ice ages, when there seems to be some sort of event, something sort of happened. Now, people think, well, maybe we just hunted all these megafauna out to extinction. Maybe there was a cataclysm. But it's a certain point around 15,000 years ago or so, the megafauna died out. The woolly mammoths, the cave bears, the giant sloths, the saber-toothed cats, all these massive, massive animals that used to roam the earth and North America and South America, giant 12-foot tall killer birds with massive beaks and teeth and things like that. They all died out. Could we have hunted these all out at the exact same time? And maybe, but on every single continent, everywhere at the exact same time, it's less likely. It's more likely that there was some sort of cataclysm, like a massive volcano or an asteroid that knocked up a whole bunch of particles into the sky, blocked out the sun, killed off a lot of vegetation, killed off a massive amount of animals, and the ones who weren't hardy enough to survive died out. So we were lucky enough to survive, but we had to change our tactics. We had to change our our prey. Normally, we were going after these big megafauna that had actually quite a high fat supply. And since then, we had to move to other sorts of means to increase our fat intake, such as cultivating cows for dairy and getting butter and milk and things like that, and moving to agricultural crops, farm agriculture and crop agriculture, in order to meet our nutritional demands or at least sustain us when we weren't able to get our natural diet. You know, some people will try to say, well, even if we were designed, you know, even though we are designed to eat meat and we've been eating meat, wild animals don't have much fat on them, so we would still have been eating lean. That's not true. The animals that we were eating for 2 million years were quite fatty. The larger an animal is, generally the higher body fat percentage it has compared to lean body mass. So you think of like an elephant or a hippopotamus or a whale. Now think of mastodons and giant sloths. They have more fat on them. And so those are the animals that we went after, were these high fat animals. And then they died out. And so that was the first step in the wrong direction. There were a lot of populations that could still eat just large animals, like the Plains Indians in North America. They would largely eat bison up until the end of the 1800s, when the bison population were wiped out systematically by the U.S. government in order to win the American Indian Wars, because that was their food supply. And so that's war tactics 101. You cut off the food supply to an army and you're going to do much better against them. So in certain areas where they didn't have 100 million plus bison roaming around and coming by yearly that they could stampede and get meat for the year, people had to go to different sorts of means. They had to go to agriculture, crop agriculture, but also animal husbandry and herding livestock and horses and so on. And that worked quite well. I mean, you look at the Mongol horde, Genghis Khan and his progeny, that carved out the largest contiguous empire that's ever existed. And they did that largely on horse meat, horse blood, and fermented mare's milk, but largely from the meat and blood of their horses. But again, dairy, right? Because you needed more fat as well. And so we know that you can have a large, massive empire running just on meat, even from a herder standpoint, but also the hunter mentality of or culture or civilization of the Plains Indians. There was huge populations. There was estimated that there was 100 million Native Americans in what is now America and North America, up until the early 1600s, when some sort of plague wiped out 95% of them. And then you go up even further north, where people were still living in the same ways, or very similar to the same ways that our ancestors had been living throughout previous ice ages, which is the Inuit, then called the Eskimo population, that were just living up in the ice and the frozen tundras in the Arctic Circle, where there wasn't anything growing to speak of, and they're eating very fatty marine mammals such as seals, polar bear, whales, things like that. So again, very high fat. And that was sort of the beginning of the end. You see this clear line in the fossil record between pre-agriculture and post-agriculture of people height and health declining. So the average height of the population dropped by 5 inches directly after the advent of agriculture. In every area around the world, it's sort of come up independently around 7 times independently in different areas around the world. And at every time, in every instance, regardless of the type of crop, regardless of the time, regardless of the people, the same things occurred. The height and health of the population declined. Height dropped by an average of 4 or 5 inches. Average brain capacity for adult males dropped by 11%. Adult female brain capacity dropped by 17%. Femurs were shorter, which is a sign of malnutrition, signs of poor wound healing, smaller jaws, crowded teeth, so they got crooked cavities, other signs of infection, such as tuberculosis in the spines. And we saw this in real time with the Native Americans, the Plains Indians, switching from bison to more agrarian sorts of means, because their food was wiped out. And so they had to shift to other food sources. And same with the Inuit in the north, same with the Maasai in Africa. As they became more westernized and involved in eating more and more Western food, the height and health of this population declined. And you can see studies throughout the 20th century of these populations showing this slow but steady decline in their health throughout the 20th century. The Inuit a bit more slow, the Maasai a bit more slow because they're a bit more separate, but the Native Americans was much more quick, like the Native United States Americans in the continental U.S. That was a much quicker decline because when we wiped out the bison, they had to switch quickly into a new mode of eating and survival. And so there's a much higher level of illness and chronic disease in the Native American population versus the rest of America, like the European descent Americans. Same is true in Australia. So the Australians were, we call these things hunter-gatherers, but really they were only gathering if they weren't able to hunt. If they weren't able to get a kill, then they would go around and get some roots and tubers or honey or whatever they would be able to find. But the records from the missionaries, the records from the European explorers going back to the 1600s were very clear. There's always, I read a couple of these and of the early explorers' works, there's always a chapter on the food of the Native Australians, and they're just marveled. They just only eat meat. They don't want anything else. Sometimes in Tasmania, they only ate mollusks like abalone. They go diving for abalone, and the Europeans actually offered them fish, just normal fish. And they just said, no, that's not what we want. This is what we eat. Now, it could be that they were just nervous about, taking food from strangers and, worried about being poisoned. But, either way, they declined. And, but this wasn't saying that, they have this mixed omnivorous diet. They were like, no, they just eat meat. They only eat meat. And these people were very healthy, very hale and hearty, very slim, slender, muscular, and very healthy. They lived pretty much untouched lives from major modern diseases. And this is something you see in anthropological works, that when these hunter-gatherer populations get more westernized and more developed, they start getting the degeneration in their health that we see in developed populations. And it's funny to me that people don't sort of wake up and think about why that is. And it's not just they're sitting down and watching television. It's because they're eating things that they never would have otherwise. And so we saw this in real time. Then the Native Americans in the plains, there was a study in 2001 that showed that at the time they were the tallest population of humans on Earth. That is not the case now. They have shrunk since then. So that's that same disparity. The Maasai in Africa, there was a multi-year study done by the British in the late 1920s, published in 1931. It was 170 pages long. And they looked at the nutrition of the Maasai, and they compared it with the Kikuyu, which were their neighboring tribe that lived at the same time, in the same area, in the same environment, in the same circumstances, and similar genetic population because they interbred and intermarried. And the Maasai were largely animal-based. They drank milk from their cattle, which was actually high fat. It was about 8% milk fat. They ate meat. They drank blood as well. And mostly the men, the warrior caste men, would have more of the meat and more of the blood because it was more nutritious and they needed it. And, people, will say like, oh, well, we're not apex predators. Go and try and fight a lion. Well, these guys did. These guys fight lions with sticks and they win. And it's pretty impressive. That because that's the thing, that was one of the coming of age sort of things. If you're a man, you go out and you kill a lion, and that's how you proved yourself to be a man. And so, yeah, that's exactly what they did. And in fact, there was a Smithsonian article in the Smithsonian magazine that I saw that said that our early ancestors probably hunted cave lions into extinction for throw rugs. Like they just like the pelts. They just wanted rugs. It's sort of funny. So then you look at that and you look at the Akikuyu, who are largely plant-based, largely vegetarian, and you look at the disparities, it's almost identical to what you'd see pre and post agriculture. The average adult male height of the Akikuyu was 5 inches shorter than the Maasai. The Maasai were 50% stronger, had 23 pounds of more lean body mass. They're all very slender, very slim. And they were much more healthy. So they looked at the health records available at the hospitals. And then because that isn't always complete, they went from village to village to village to village to village and did their own medical assessments of the Akikuyu and the Maasai. And there were quite a lot. There's a big study. At the time, the Akikuyu were numbered about 750,000. Obviously, they didn't look at all of them, but they had quite a large patient sample size. And they found that the Akikuyu men were the unhealthiest of all. The Akikuyu women were second unhealthiest, but they had a bit more of a diverse diet. Instead of just eating a whole bunch of grains, they ate grains as well as veggies and greens and things like that. Then it was the Maasai women. Then it was the Maasai men. The Maasai men had almost no health issues to speak of. They found that the Akikuyu men and women had a number of nutritional deficiencies, but when they just supplemented those deficiencies, their health issues didn't improve. It was only until they replaced the plants they were eating with meat that their health improved, which sort of goes to show you that there are other nutrients that we don't necessarily know about, or certainly didn't at the time, that are required and essential, but also that the plants that they were eating can hold low-grade toxins and give low-grade toxicity and other sorts of problems. Even just eating a lot of grains, we know this to be detrimental to our metabolic health. And ketogenic diets have been the most studied diet on Earth, and the most rigorously studied, has the most high-level evidence to support it, as opposed to just epidemiological studies saying like, oh, just backtrack and how much vegetables have you eaten in the last 2 years? Like, okay, oh yeah, people that ate more vegetables, they do better. I'm like, well, very rigorous, right? But ketogenic diets have been tested with randomized controlled trials, interventional trials by the thousands. I mean, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of studies for this. So even that, even just that, I mean, it can make a difference. That's that disparity. You see that clear disparity. We see the clear disparity here with the Australian Aboriginals, where, you know, when I first got here, and I'm sure this is something you're well aware of being a doctor here in Australia, but I was told pretty much day one when I got here was that if you have an Native Australian patient, that whatever their age says on their folder, just add 20 years to that, because they just age so much faster than everybody else. So if you have someone in their 30s, you have to consider them an elderly population. You have to consider the diseases that you would normally see in the elderly population. Why is that? Why are they aging so much quicker? Because they haven't had 10,000 years to adapt to agrarian food, and it's not suited to them, even more so than it's not suited to us. The height and health decline. So we know about the health. What about the height? Well, there were far more taller Native Australians previously. There was a war in Western Australia, sort of northern Western Australia, in the mid-1800s, I think the 1850s, 40s or 50s. And with the British, it was pretty one-sided, so there were a lot of casualties on the indigenous side. A couple of years later, you know, people are coming back. The British soldiers are coming back and looking at at that battle site, and they found just, you know, a lot of skeletons around, and they were pretty taken aback because they looked at they found the forearm bones of the Native Australians. They found just the radius and ulna just sitting there, and they said that it was longer than the British soldier's entire outstretched arm. Just their forearm was longer than their entire arm. I mean, just imagine that. Like, that if someone's coming up and their whole outstretched arm is just going up to your wrist, you know, that's like, it's like a child, you know? So that there's quite a massive disparity in height that we saw directly after that as well. So this is just typical. We're animals, just like every other animal. We have a specific set of nutrients and requirements for life and for optimal development and health. And there are certain things that will harm us. There are certain things that will harm us that won't harm other things. And so if we don't eat what we're designed to eat, we aren't going to be as healthy as we can be. And that's the same for every other animal. There was a massive decrease in decline in the height and health of these population of the Native Australian population, as well as the Native Americans. Then you look at the Maasai to sort of jump back a bit. They were extremely healthy in the late 1920s and 30s when they were mostly eating meat and dairy. But even then, they had started eating in some grains and millet seeds. They had started including this in their diet. And yet, they were still very healthy. Then you look over in the 1970s, and you know, there's someone tried to say, like, oh, the Maasai aren't that healthy. Look at this. There's these reports of heart disease in the Maasai in the 1970s. It's like, great. Thank you for proving my point. It didn't exist in the 1920s and 30s. Now it exists in the 1970s. And what are they eating now? They're eating more grains, they're eating more plants, or more agrarian, plant agrarian than they were in the 1920s and 30s. So that fits perfectly with that paradigm. And then now the health is much worse. And so, you know, I spoke with someone and said, oh, well, look, I have a house over in the Maasai Mara, and I see them, you know, they're actually eating all these other things. Great. Thank you for proving my point. They're not as healthy as they were even in the 1970s. They're much more sick now, and their diabetes rates are way higher. Their teeth are getting problematic and decayed, and smaller jaws and crooked teeth and other sort of metabolic issues that they've never had before. Now that's becoming a problem. Well, one thing that they have is they eat a lot more corn, they eat a lot more grain, they eat a lot more plants. But most notably is that in many of these villages, they have Coca-Cola trucks drive in every single day and sell out within minutes. And they have no idea how bad this stuff is for them, which is very predatory by Coca-Cola and these other companies, because they're going into these areas. They have no idea how bad this is for them. And you, at least in America and Australia and the rest of the world, we at least know, like, you probably should limit it. You don't really want to have all that much sugar. They have no idea. And so Dr. Mark Hyman.
It's like a heroin dealer going into a high school.
Well, that's it. Yeah. There's no idea, you know, or like the opium trade back before it was illegal. It was just like, oh, hey, look, yeah, you can do this. This is fun. This is great. And it's not as profound a response as opium or heroin, but it's the same idea. You're getting them addicted and they don't realize that this is causing harm. And it is causing harm. It is addictive. It's addictive in the same way as cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamines. There's studies in mice showing that if there was the classic study of a mouse is given two options. They can hit a button for food, or they can hit a button and get a hit of cocaine, but they can't get both. So they have to choose one or the other, and the mice will keep choosing cocaine until they die. Right. Well, in more recent studies, they added in a third button, which was sugar. And so they could get food, they could get cocaine, or they could get sugar. And most of the mice just kept hitting sugar until they died. And they didn't even go for the cocaine, let alone the food. And so, you know, this stuff is terribly addictive. And it's sort of, you can sort of think of it as an evolutionary trap. There's things called evolutionary traps, where something is designed to seek out a certain something. Right. Or at least they recognize it as safe. They recognize it as good. There's an example of this would be, there are hummingbirds in America that go after just red flowers. Right. And for a while in cattle country, they had these red sort of fixers for the electric wires, electric fencing. And so they would sort of twist these things together. I would hold those wires together, and these hummingbirds would come in, think this is a flower, to see that red and that around the right size, around the right shape, and red, and they just go in, get the nectar, hit the hot wire, and die, right? So this was killing a lot of hummingbirds. And so that's called an evolutionary trap. They're designed to say, this is where I need to go. So fructose is thought to be the sweetest of the sugars because we don't know of anything containing fructose that's acutely poisonous, will kill us on that day. And so we have that sweetness, and it is addictive, and it gives a dopamine response to the addiction centers of the brain, the reward centers of your brain, just like cocaine, heroin, and meth. And there are MRI studies showing that it kills the same areas of the brain as meth, to the same extent as meth, and it damages the body similar to alcohol because it gets broken down into the same byproducts as alcohol. And so we get fatty liver disease, cirrhosis, diabetes, heart disease, even implicated in cancer and Alzheimer's. And so we take this taste. Normally we get in very small quantities from some sort of fruit or something. If we were starving, we see that and we go, okay, this is safe. I can eat this and survive. And now we're getting fruit with hundreds of times the amount of fructose in it. And we're getting candies with refined concentrated sugar in it. They're putting sugar in absolutely every food stuff. You're getting Coca-Cola that has a ton of sugar in it, but it has even more sugar than you would think because they add salt to it. In the culinary world, salt offsets the flavor of sugar. And so if something's too sweet, you add salt to it, it diminishes the sweet flavor that you experience. And vice versa, if something's too salty, you add a bit of sugar to it, and it'll diminish that salty taste. So Coca-Cola does this on purpose. They know what they're doing. So they add a whole bunch of salt in so they can add even more sugar and get this more addictive. So you have more, and the salt has the added benefit of dehydrating you, so you want to drink more as well. So it's just a win-win for them. You just drink more of their nasty, disgusting product. And so we hit that, and that is an evolutionary trap for us. We say, our body says, that's safe. You can do this. This gives you energy. Go for it. Because we're never experiencing and encountering it in this magnitude. Mangoes, people say, well, mangoes are very sweet. Yeah, but they didn't used to be. The original mangoes were barely sweet at all. They had a lot of fibrous tissue. The seed was massive. It had very little pulp to it. And so, yeah, so this is just an evolutionary trap for us. We recognize this is safe and our body go more, and it's addictive. So we really go more. And so, you know, it's just very, very harmful, you know? And so the Maasai are now being caught with that evolutionary trap for the profit of these just absolutely diabolical companies. And so they have these Coca-Cola trucks that are going in. Dr. Mark Hyman from the Cleveland Clinic did a trip out there, sort of a research trip out to the Maasai. And he saw this and he was horrified. And he sort of made a video about it and published it about how these Coca-Cola trucks were coming in every day and they were selling out very quickly. And he went to the chief of the little village that he was staying in. And he just let him know. He said, hey, you know, that stuff's really not good for you. It can cause diabetes, it can cause obesity, it can cause tooth decay and all these problems. And the chief was taken aback. He said, well, really? Like, we actually have a huge problem with diabetes and we have no idea why. Well, that's part of the reason anyway. So we are seeing this decline and degradation in the health of people right now for European ancestors, Middle Eastern ancestors, and parts of Asia and North Africa and things like that. That disparity happened, you know, 8 to 10,000 years ago. But we're seeing that, we see this in the fossil record then, and we see this in real time right now. We're seeing the degradation of the health of these populations. The cancer rates in the Inuit were extremely low, if you know, infinitesimally small in the early 1900s. And there are studies that look at 20-year chunks in the literature, and it's just slowly but surely increasing the cancer rate, increasing the cancer rate, increasing the cancer rate. Well, what's happening throughout the 20th century, they're becoming more and more incorporated into Western society. And so so some of the studies differentiate between the native Inuits that are still eating a native diet and they have next to no chronic disease, heart disease or cancer. And then you have the ones that look at just the entire population of the Inuit and say, well, maybe there's something to do with them. Maybe there's something genetic and all these sorts of things. No, it's what they're eating. When they're eating their traditional diet, they don't get these diseases. When they're in the cities, they're actually quite prone to getting these diseases because they're actually genetically susceptible to getting heart disease. That was a study in the 1990s, I think 1996 or 97, where they said, well, hey, look, I mean, these guys are just eating a whole bunch of fat, and obviously that's going to kill you. They start smoking very young, and that's obviously not good for heart disease. And yet they, as a total population, not even just the ones living in their traditional way, as a total population, they were still much lower rates of heart disease than the rest of Canada. And so they said, okay, well, maybe there's genetic protections that they have. So they looked at the different genetic markers that would protect or predispose them from getting heart disease. They found they basically had all of them. They had all the bad ones. They were just very much genetically susceptible to developing heart disease, and yet they weren't. And then you look in the 2000s and the 2010s, and then you start seeing as a population higher rates of heart disease. And so, you know, dishonest actors, such as our vegan friends, are not really the vegans, but the vegan influencers that are trying to make a name for themselves and a dime trying to push this ideology will try to confound that. They'll try to say, well, look at this study that was done in the last 5 years, and they have higher rates of these chronic diseases as a population of Inuit, not as people only eating the traditional diet. And that's the crux there. And so they know that. They're just trying to confuse people and trying to mislead people. But that's what it is. We're seeing the health of our people and our civilizations decline. We're eating more and more things that aren't designed for us. We're eating more and more processed food. In the last 100 years, we've had a massive increase in chronic disease, more than we've ever seen in history. And in the last 40 years, it's continued to increase decade after decade after decade. We're not eating more meat. We're eating less red meat, certainly. Total meat has been about the same because it's been replaced with chicken. These are U.S. numbers. But red meat's declined. Saturated fats declined. Cholesterol intake has declined. Fruits and vegetables have increased. Grains have increased. Heart-healthy grains, heart-healthy fruits and vegetables, heart-healthy polyunsaturated fatty acids have increased, tripled, in fact, since the 1970s. And so is sugar. Sugar's increased by over threefold as well in the form of high fructose corn syrup. And so since then, we have gotten fatter and sicker than we've ever been in human history. And people try to, again, conflate and lie and dissemble. But that's the facts. You know, they said, well, you know, age-adjusted mortality rates have peaked in the 1960s and 70s and then started coming down. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the rates. We're talking about the prevalence and incidence of heart disease is going up. And it is going up decade after decade. And the mortality rate around the world is going up. And it's going up higher and faster than the growth in population. And so, you know, that's not good. So the rate is going up. People having their first heart attacks is going up. And it's just that we have better interventions. We have better hospital systems and ambulance services. We can have the Royal Flying Doctors fly out to middle of nowhere, Australia, and bring someone back in and get them to a cath lab where otherwise, well, you know, 20 years ago, they would have been dead. Right. And so, you know, that's something that we can do for people now. And that's improving things. Also, the rates of smoking have gone way down. And so that's going to improve things as well. But people having their first heart attack, but surviving, are going up. And that's important. And people say, well, we're just screening techniques are getting better. Dumb. The screening techniques has nothing to do with a first time heart attack, unless you're calling heart attacks screening method. You know, wait for someone to have a heart attack and then they have, it is a good screening. It's pretty sensitive and specific, but that's the thing. People are having first time heart attacks more often. It's just that they're surviving, and the rates of chronic disease, of autoimmune diseases, of diabetes is going up and up and up, and is happening younger and younger and younger. And so the idea that we're just, you know, the epitome of health and just getting better and better, and it's because we stopped eating meat, is just ludicrous. But people make this argument. It's absolutely hilarious to me that people in their right mind are actually trying to argue this, and they just look around them. Everyone's getting fatter and sicker, and it's just, you know, and that yet they're arguing and trying to play with the statistics to make it look as if it's not happening, which is hilarious. But as Mark Twain said, there are three kinds of lies. There are lies, there are damn lies, and there are statistics. And that's what we're seeing now.
It's fascinating to take this ancestral and traditional people's perspective, because I think it offers so much into giving people a reference about what is normal. And one of my earliest medical school lessons from a very experienced GP was know your anatomy, but know what's normal. Because you don't want to be the guy who infuses 4 liters of normal saline into, you know, a 45 kilo little woman whose blood pressure, systolic blood pressure, is naturally sitting at 90. You don't want to be the guy who doesn't realize that that is normal blood pressure for that person. So I think what you've basically described so eloquently, Anthony, is that collectively as a society, we have forgotten what is normal as a human diet. And I think that people are incredibly surprised when they realize how much protein and how much fat and how many animal-derived nutrients they truly need to thrive. And most people are eating nowhere near that. And it's, you know, there's differences in, say, you know, your approach compared to, say, Dr. Paul Saladino, in terms of, you know, he's advocating for fruit and honey. I think it's the nuance that he's not communicating is that he's living at an equatorial latitude and it's very, very local, locally grown produce, which is the reason why he hasn't got any visceral fat and his fasting insulin still 3. But I think overwhelmingly, the foundation of that diet is still very, very high in animal fat and animal meat. Mm. I just wanted to go back to the study that you referenced in the early 1900s in Africa with the Maasai. And mm-hmm. I just want to emphasize the point that that is a very, very elegantly controlled study, because you can imagine that those two populations have the same cultural practices, the same sun exposure, the same they're in the same environment. The only factor that was changing was their dietary practices. So, you know, people like some people will say, oh, it's because they're more sun exposed or they were outside more. Well, that study really proves that the only factor that was different between these two people was that one was eating a very high meat-based diet, the Maasai, and the Akungu were primarily agrarian. So that's a really excellent anthropological and observational, but essentially almost like a random, a very controlled type of trial. The other point I really wanted to make, because it's important when we are kind of fighting back against this message that humans were sick ancestrally. And you hear it from vegan influencers who are very much on the same team as a lot of centralized cardiologists who are pushing pharmaceutical intervention, like primary prevention, that it seems to be quite excessive and not really accounting for the fact that we didn't have heart disease traditionally and ancestrally. So talk to us about this idea that prior to the development of civilization, there wasn't disease around. And I think that the records like Weston A. Price's work shows that people were actually quite healthy prior to the contact with Western civilization.
Well, I mean, you don't even, yeah. I mean, there's this concept of the diseases of the West when we met these non-Western cultures, these so-called hunter-gatherer, really hunter populations, that they did not get the same diseases that the Europeans did. And so they said, oh, well, these are just people from the West get these diseases. These natives here, they don't get that. They don't get the diseases. So they called it the diseases of the West. And now we just call it getting older. And now it's starting to be termed human diseases, because now dogs and cats and domesticated animals of other descriptions are starting to have an increased prevalence decade after decade of so-called human diseases, these diseases that humans only get. Normally other animals don't get this, but then zoo animals, if you don't feed them their natural food, they will get these human diseases as well. And if you ask a zookeeper who, you know, tends the animals and feeds them in a responsible zoo, ask them, well, what do you give them, like dog food and kibble or bread or whatever? And they'll just look at you horrified. Like, are you kidding me? You know, if you do that, if you give animals human food, they'll get human diseases. You know, it's like, okay, what the hell is a human disease? And why can you get it from eating human food? What does that mean? That means the food is causing the disease. And this isn't food. This isn't food for us. It's not food for them. Food is species specific. Food is what you've evolved on. Food is what you're biologically adapted and suited to. Seed oils that haven't existed for more than 100 years or so, that is not food. How can it be? We've never encountered it before. It certainly can't be essential. It certainly can't be important for our heart to have it, or else we'll get heart disease, or else before its advent, we would all have been dying of heart disease, and then heart disease would have declined, where in fact, heart disease wasn't even heard of, and then it started to massively increase after the advent of seed oils and refined sugars, refined grains, and processed food industry came to bear. If you don't even have to go all the way back to the beginning of civilization. I mean, it was hard to say, you know, what cavemen you know, if they had any sort of chronic disease, but we certainly didn't see any signs in their bones. We didn't see signs of tuberculosis eating away their spines like we did in post-agricultural people. We didn't see signs of poor wound healing like we did in post-agricultural people. We didn't see signs of arthritis, osteoarthritis, or osteoporosis, or other signs of degenerative diseases. And so some people argue that, well, but people are dying in their 30s. How the hell would you know? How would anybody know? I mean, this is something 20,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, you weren't there. There are no records from there. There's no census data because this is prehistoric. So this is before the written word. And so, of course, there aren't any records of this. Like, well, but the bones, they look so young and so healthy. Okay. They're just healthy. The whole point is they weren't degrading. And so they could live much longer in a much more healthy fashion. And so you can't find those signs of degradation. But you know what? You can't find those in an elephant either. You can't find those in an elephant that dies of old age because they don't get it. They don't get osteoporosis. They don't get osteoarthritis if they're eating their natural diet. And so, you know, you don't see, you know, elephants walking down the Serengeti and then popping a hip and falling over with a broken hip because they've got arthritis or osteoporosis. You don't see that at the zoo either, because they say in the wild, well, they get killed by lions or other sorts of things. So maybe they don't live long enough to get it. Well, first of all, a lot of them do actually. But in the zoo, these animals are living out their natural lifespan and they're not breaking their hips and they're not shattering their bones. They have a lot of weight behind them. And yet their bones are holding them up. They're not getting degeneration like we see in human populations. And so, you know, we just don't see these problems. But either way, you don't need to go back all that, you know, to the prehistoric record to see what was going on. We can just go back to the 1800s when we did have census data. And we had actually quite robust census data in America and in Europe and in Australia. And there was no heart disease. There were no recorded heart attacks. The first recorded death from myocardial infarction proven on autopsy in America was in 1912. And no one believed him. And they said, look, we've all seen thousands and thousands and thousands of autopsies. We've got medical records going back hundreds of years. You know, no one's seen this. We don't think you got this right. We think you got this wrong. And they didn't start believing him until about 10 years later when they started seeing more of these crop up. And they said, oh, okay, maybe there's a new disease popping its head out. Okay. 10 years after that, it's the number one killer in America. You know, we were doing autopsies. We were doing thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of autopsies. I mean, everybody was doing thousands each. This was a major, major part of medicine for hundreds of years, was just doing dissections. You were just dissecting. You were trying to find what was normal and see what was abnormal and find something different. And if you describe something different, you got your name down in the record books forever, like Alzheimer's disease. I know nothing about Dr. Alzheimer's except for the fact that he presented a case in 1906 about a lady who developed this weird presentation of memory and confusion issues that was later termed Alzheimer's dementia. 1906. There wasn't a single mention of any other dementia type illness that by any other name that fit the description of Alzheimer's dementia before that in the medical literature. None. And now it's one of the most common things that you'll ever see. People say, you know, I had a professor in medical school that said, well, if you live long enough, everyone's going to get dementia. Oh, yeah, it was because our brains are just designed to break down, just like we're designed to make LDL cholesterol that is designed to kill us and give us heart disease. It makes no sense. It makes no sense your body would just do that and degrade. It doesn't. Well, after you get past a certain age and you've already made your reproductive criteria, then your body just disappears and dies. Well, you know, it does do that, but it doesn't kill you of disease. I mean, you do break down and eventually die. But there is an advantage to having multi-generational families and homes and civilizations where you have this living memory and knowledge and helping with the young and rearing kids and raising people and educating people and things like that. There's absolutely a survival advantage to that. And also it just didn't happen. You know, we don't see elephants just getting Alzheimer's and being goofy and having major problems and like that we see in adult human populations. But people regularly lived a long time. So, people just didn't live long enough. Not true. Census data in the 1850s, all the way up through to the 2020s shows very clear that the average life expectancy from birth was 38 in 1850. But then if they made it to 10 years old, because they were smarter than the people making these arguments, they looked at it every 10 years. If you made it to 20 years, you'd live to be around 60. If you made it to 20 years old, you make it past that and past that and past that. So infant mortality rates were very high. So obviously the average life expectancy from birth goes down. But if you made it into adulthood and you weren't killed in a war, you actually lived a very long time. My great grandfather was born in 1875. He died in 1975. He was a doctor and trained at Columbia Medical School. And there was a second class ever taught sterile practice. It was right at the advent of anesthesia, right? So there's just he was on the ground floor of modern surgery, and he actually, invented his own surgeries and surgical equipment. So amazing having that living memory to be able to tell my parents and my relatives all his experiences and things like that. There's absolutely an advantage to that. His father and mother lived nearly the same amount. His brothers lived nearly the same amount of time. Their grandparents lived nearly the same amount of time, because when people died of old age, they lived a much longer than these averages from birth. And they did not get dementia in the numbers that we're seeing now. And like I said, Alzheimer's just wasn't seen at all in the literature before 1906. And the first diagnosed on autopsy MI was in 1912. We were eating more meat in the 1800s. According to the United States census data, than we were in the early 20th century. So we're eating much more meat in the early 1800s than in the early 1900s. We're eating far more meat in the early 1800s than we were in 1912 when the first heart attack showed up. And we're eating more meat in 1912 than when we were in 1920, 1930, when it became the number one killer in America. And that was actually the lowest point in eating meat in the 200-year period. Before and after, sort of a U-shaped curve. And so, we had all sorts of other diseases. We had, William Osler, one of the great teachers in medicine, wrote this whole massive tomes on the medical conditions of the day in the late 1800s. He was the first professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins. I have one of his original textbooks. It was my great-grandfather's textbook that he had. And it says nothing about heart disease. You're talking about angina, and he had six patients in his entire career that could have had angina-like symptoms. We don't know exactly what it's caused by. There's an obscure reference to a conference in the late 1700s where people said they saw one case of a thrombus in the coronary arteries. And they said, oh, hey, look, this might have been how someone died. Look at that. So people were paying attention. They could see this stuff. And they saw it potentially once in the late 1700s. And then never again until 1912, right? At least in America. So this did not exist. It just did not exist in the numbers that we're seeing it today. And the numbers that we're seeing are getting more and more prevalent. They're just getting, every decade, it's getting more common and more common and more common. More people are having first-time heart attacks. More people around the world are having heart attacks. I saw a very disturbing statistic the other week, which was that one in four Indian men will die of a heart attack. Are we saying that that was happening this whole time? Were we saying that that was happening for thousands of years, and we just didn't realize it? I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. People are a lot smarter than that. And Leonardo da Vinci, the guy invented a helicopter 500 years ago, and he did hundreds, thousands of autopsies because he was given permission by the Catholic Church. That was sort of the early onset of when you were able to do dissections and things like that, because before that it was considered sacrilege. But the artists were allowed to do that so that they could more perfectly describe in their art the human form. And so Da Vinci was doing thousands of autopsies and dissections, and kept copious notes. You think he was just too dumb to notice a massive blockage in the whole coronaries? I mean, that he'd never seen before, and just all of a sudden, oh yeah, whatever. You just have to be trying to fool yourself if you believe things like that.
The other interesting point that I think is relevant is that the disease prevalence of the familial hypercholesterolemia conditions would have been the same. That hasn't changed between today and back then. Yet there's still only 11 cases of AMI in William Osler's whole career. So, I mean, that's in itself is pretty compelling evidence that it's an environmental change, not any kind of inherent problem that we're spontaneously, you know, developing these coronary thromboses as part of some.
No, that's a very good point. Yeah.
You've raised so many interesting points, and Anthony, really, it's just so obvious from what you've described that it's obviously not the meat. It's not the red meat, it's not the cholesterol that is really driving this disease epidemic. I've been more and more digging into the mitochondria and how a lot of these chronic diseases, Alzheimer's included, is essentially mitochondrial failure. And it's essentially when we get a degree of bioenergetic breakdown in individual cells and that is sufficient in one organ, then the organ starts failing, whether that's dementia, heart failure, autoimmune disease, so to speak. So I guess my thought is that something environmental, and obviously diet is kind of the big one that you're talking about. And the only other factor that I think has changed as significantly has been our light environment. And for the listeners, essentially in the late 1870s was the electrification of the first electrification with Edison and the World Fair. And they brought light at night. And prior to that, there was no artificial light at night. It was only fire. It was only halogen. Fire and moonlight. And so when, I guess, we're taking this mitochondrial perspective and then we're suddenly lighting up our night, and obviously we need melatonin that gets produced from our pineal gland to keep that circadian rhythm regulated. The only other thing that I think provides us a compelling contributor to all the diseases that you've described is the fact that people are now sitting up exposed to a whole bunch of artificial light and therefore preventing those mitochondria from recovering as they would appropriately with that perfectly symmetrical circadian signal of daylight and completely dark night. So do you have any thoughts on the contribution of light to these chronic health issues?
Well, I mean, you're certainly more well-versed than I am in that, but I completely agree with you, you know, that this is we're going outside of our biological design, you know, and we're doing that with food. We're doing that with our environmental toxins. There are about a million different new chemicals that have been patented since the 1970s. What the hell do those do? Most of these are for the beauty and scent sort of industries or cleaning industries and things like that. So we're getting chronic exposure to these sorts of things. We're putting on makeups and lotions and tinctures and shampoos and cleaning with random things. It's all getting in our body. It's all, you know, a lot of these things can soak through our skin and can damage our body. And then exactly right. You know, where our brains tell the time on by the frequency of light that comes in. And so you're just getting inundated with this, you know, specific beam of light, and our brain just doesn't know what the hell is going on. It doesn't know what time it is. Doesn't know what to release. You know, if you go out in the morning and you get that morning light, your brain goes, oh, it's morning time. Here are your morning hormones. And then it sets you up for the rest of the day. Afternoon. Okay. It's afternoon. Here are your afternoon hormones. We're going to do this now. Evening, same thing. And so it just sets you up for your circadian rhythm, which, you know, I was taught in grade school was extremely important. And yet we have forgotten just how important a light is to that. And, you know, but this is something that they were even talking about in the 80s, that these fluorescent lights in these office buildings where everyone's in these cubicles with this fake fluorescent light, it was just making everyone sick and miserable and awful. I mean, we've been talking about this for decades, but now people are actually starting to quantify it and show exactly what's damaging it. And that's something that I'm not as well versed in, but I certainly agree with the concept. And so it's something that I think is well worth people taking note of, trying to get away from this artificial light, trying to get more natural light, you know, wearing the blue blocking glasses at night, trying to stay away from exactly what we're doing here as much as possible at, the, yeah. at this exact time.
The other interesting question, which is especially relevant for heart disease, is what do you think the factors were that were driving that peak around the time that Eisenhower had his heart attack? Because I read The Clot Thickens by Malcolm Kendrick, and obviously the seed oils had come on the scene in the early 1910s. And so I think that was a major unappreciated driver of heart disease. Mm-hmm. We've just talked about light. Have you thought about lead, or the fact that there was a lot of lead in the petroleum and the fuel? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what factors are you really attributing that initial kind of early 1900s rise in heart disease to?
Well, it could certainly be things like lead and the pollutants that we were putting out. You know, one thing that we have seen, the wealthier that America and Western countries have gotten, the cleaner they've gotten as well. You know, we're not like Beijing where it's just smog all the time, or at least historically it has been very, very poor air quality. Now you go to a major city in America or Australia and it's bright blue skies and things like that. They don't have the smog and the coal smoke and things like that they used to have, but these rates are still going up. So I think I'm sure that those sorts of things were contributory, but they don't seem to be the main driver. There are other things going on. I think it's definitely things like seed oils, things like sugars, things like refined processed foods. We're eating things we're not designed for. We're raising our blood sugar, which causes glycation. The glucose molecules physically fuse other molecules, permanently damage them, cause advanced glycation end products. You have things like nicotine. People were smoking a lot in the early 1900s. Eisenhower was a three-pack a day smoker. But you know what's interesting to me is that, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, 80% of men smoked, and they did not have the lung cancer rates that they had. Now they did not have the heart disease rates that they had now. So it's something that's probably contributory, but not the only thing necessary. Also, we have to think about how cigarettes were made. You know, we were smoking quite abundantly for hundreds of years before the 1900s. And yet again, we still don't see this prevalence of heart disease. Nicotine is known to cause damage. And this is something that Malcolm Kendrick talks about, is that even if it were cholesterol building up behind the walls of our arteries, they can't physically get there unless there's a physical break in the barrier. There's some sort of damage to the artery lining. And that's something that nicotine, well, at least when I was going through medical school, we were taught that nicotine can directly damage and cause abrasions and breaks and cuts in the artery lining of our arteries. And so that's something, but we should have seen that going on for a long time. And you know, we do look at other sort of mummified structures and they have bits of signs of atherosclerosis. Maybe they can also, because these are mummies, they could be confused with other sorts of things such as kidney failure and osteoporosis and things like that actually can show a similar sort of picture on these mummies. So they don't actually know for sure. And so we should take that with a grain of salt as well. But one of the things that did change in the 1900s was that how cigarettes were cured. They actually went to a chemical flu drying cure with a bunch of formaldehyde and other sorts of horrific chemicals that are absolutely carcinogenic and damaging to the body. And I remember seeing a study when I was in high school, actually, where they took, you know, cancer-prone mice and they exposed them to naturally cured tobacco and then to the modern flu-dried tobacco, which is much quicker process. You can get the product to market much quicker and it's less expensive. And the cancer-prone mice, given the normal cigarettes, tons of cancer, you know, atherosclerosis, peripheral vascular disease, all the rest. But the ones given exposed to the smoke from the naturally cured tobacco, they got the peripheral vascular disease and the other sorts of problems, the emphysema, but they didn't get cancer, interestingly enough. And it's certainly not in the rates that that the other ones did. So I think that, that that's also an interesting thing too, that our the nasty things we're exposing ourselves to got more nasty as well. But there's a very strong correlation between the advent of seed oils and increased use of seed oils and heart disease. Same with sugar as it goes up. There's very closely related. And that was argued for decades that it was actually sugar was the main culprit. They didn't even necessarily know that Crisco was just bloody toxic. And we understand now we've banned trans fats for to a large degree in most Western countries because this has been accepted as a major driver for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. That comes from plants. That's partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, right? And so when you cook with these seed oils, it can turn some of them into trans fats. And we cook with this stuff all the time. But also they cause all sorts of other problems, like mitochondrial damage. The omega-6s like linoleic acid cause direct damage to the mitochondria. So I think that that's a large part of this. You know, we introduce things into our diet that we have never seen before, to this extent. And we got very sick. You know, there was something called the Ebers Papyrus, which is an ancient Egyptian document, you know, like 4,000 years ago or so. I don't know the exact date. And it's a medical document, and they described angina, and they described diabetes and all these other sorts of modern diseases that we didn't see for thousands of years after that. But the Egyptians were eating a lot of grains. And they used that to make alcohol. So they had a lot of alcohol, a lot of grains. So, and obviously people drank alcohol since then. They ate grains since then, but perhaps not to the extent that the Egyptians did in this period of time. And so I think that this is in large part due to what we're eating and the seed oils that have come in, the added sugars that have come in, and you know, just the rest of the exposures to our bodies that we're not used to. Alcohol, we've sort of always been drinking, sort of always been smoking. But the cigarettes have changed. We're adding sugar to all the drinks. And, you know, there's massive sort of increases in all these other things. So these are all going to be contributory, but the other things have just pushed us over the edge to this massive increase in chronic disease. And, you know, some of these things are protective. Like there was, I'm forgetting what it was. It was so long ago that I saw this, but there are chemicals basically in the body that have been shown to cause damage to the artery lining. And basically they get sucked up by a lot of the B vitamins. And so like, you know, B12 and folate and things like that. And so, you know, one researcher that my dad knew when he was talking about this said that, not talking to, but seeing a presentation of his. And he said that, you know, we don't have any human models clinically proving all these sort of stuff, but, you know, this is like you get this damage to artery lining, and this is how this stuff builds up. And this stuff is known to damage the artery lining, and these B vitamins like B12 and so on will just mop these suckers up. And so, you know, it's cheap. It's easy to get, you know, might as well just make sure you have enough of it. It's not going to hurt. When we started replacing meat with these other sort of products and we're losing out on the B vitamins, we're getting slightly more and more malnourished. Well, it could be that we're not able to soak up and block out these different sorts of molecules, homocysteine, things like that.
I was going to say that. Yeah. Homocysteine goes up if you're B12 folate riboflavin deficient. So it makes...
I'm pretty sure it was homocysteine that this guy was talking about.
It makes
about.
Complete sense that if you're chronically vitamin B deficient, you're going to increase your risk of developing atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. The endothelial damage point is so important. The reason is because Malcolm Kendrick spelled that out in his book, is because it's what I believe and you believe is actually behind the disease process of atherosclerosis and atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, and not the fact that we just have the presence of ApoB and LDL particles just kind of bouncing around in our blood vessel, and suddenly you know, forming a plaque in a healthy artery. It's just that idea is...
Which we make and which we've always made. And just now somehow is causing just a crazy problem.
It doesn't make any sense. And I really want to reference a mutual guest that we both discussed on our podcast, which is Stephen Hussey. And Stephen Hussey has made the point, and he's just obviously packaging work of other people too, is that we have a very special type of water called exclusion zone or structured water that forms inside the blood vessel, even above the glycocalyx. So if you imagine the endothelial cells are protected from the blood by this these stalks of mucus-like molecules called the glycocalyx. But even above that, there is a zone of water that is potentiated by infrared light and by grounding and by other factors that you get in nature. And that exclusion zone water is so impenetrable that nothing bigger than a potassium ion can get through it. So to damage or to start forming plaque, first you have to disturb that exclusion zone water. Then you have to start attacking the glycocalyx with things like particulates from smoking or from chronically high blood pressure, or obviously from having high hyperglycemia for years on end. And then you get to the endothelial damage. And once you start damaging those cells, the scab essentially forms and you get deposition of plaque, you know, year after year after year. So I want to really make that point because emphasize that the way that atherosclerosis is kind of treated and prevented is really focusing on cholesterol. It's focusing on saturated fat still, even though there's a lack of evidence that that is, part of the pathogenesis. Yet when we're missing out this key aspect that it's the endothelial health that is really the determinant of who's going to start laying down plaque or not.
Yeah. And, like we said, I mean, this stuff, it doesn't make sense in any other sort of way. You know, we say that it's this cholesterol, like you said, you know, the percentage of population that has familial hypercholesterolemia is the same now as it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or, you know, even 50 years ago when the rates were different. 100 years before that, it was very different. And yet we had all these people with familial hypercholesterolemia that would have had very high levels of LDL. Why would we make LDL if LDL was just toxic to us? That doesn't make sense. You know, that would have been bred out of the species long ago, unless it conferred more benefit than harm. But if it's just causing us to just get sick and die, that doesn't make any sense. And if we're eating our natural diet for 2 million years and that somehow is making this worse and we're getting sick and we're dying because of that, then we would have adapted to this, because the people that would have survived better and lived longer would have been the ones surviving. Just like the European, you know, ancestors of the Europeans who had, and Sumerians who had early agriculture, they've built up slow but steady, small defenses towards plant toxins and this inappropriate food. So that's exactly what would have happened if we were eating meat for millions of years and this were harmful to us. We would have started developing these adaptations. And that's the people that are just flat out science deniers. They're just, you know, fact deniers, that this is how biology works. That, you know, it's the immutable law of biology is that of adaptation. Life adapts to pressures in the system or they die. That is what happens. And so we were more than adapted to eating meat because that's what we've always been eating. And then I remember Simon Hill made the sort of insane argument that just because people have been eating meat for millions of years doesn't mean that it's good for us. And I was like, well, it does actually. That's exactly what it means. And so he was saying, oh, well, you don't know. These people have been, you know, could have been dying in their 30s. All they had to do is reproduce. They just, you know, have kids at 14 and then they just die off. It's like, someone has to raise the kid, jackass. You have to actually get that kid up to adulthood or they're just going to die of exposure. And then it actually does confer benefit to have multi-generational families. And in fact, that's what we see in these hunter-gatherer populations, these multi-generational families. And also, you know, the idea that everyone was just dying of heart disease and cancer and diabetes, there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence. And so I point that out, and, you know, instead of actually, you know, trying to discuss it with me, he tries to make a slam video about this and saying that, oh, well, I never said that. I mean, they're dying of, you know, getting killed by tigers and dying of famines and blah, 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 blah. I never said that they they died of chronic disease. Like, no, that's literally exactly what you said, because you said that meat eating that way causes chronic disease. It causes heart disease, cancer, diabetes, autoimmunity. You said that. And we're saying, okay, but these people have been doing that for 2 million years, nearly exclusively, especially during the ice ages. And what about that? Oh, well, they didn't have to be healthy. They could have just made it to reproduction age. Okay. And then they were dying of these chronic diseases. That is what you are saying. That is the argument that you're saying. And there is zero evidence of that. In fact, there is evidence to the contrary of that. We don't see any signs of degradation and degeneration in the fossil record. These things, bastards were healthy as hell. They're much taller, much healthier, much bigger brains, much better teeth, certainly much bigger brain than the people making that argument against it. So it is just denial at this point.
And really, I'm really glad you brought up Simon Hill, because for my listeners, he's a vegan diet influencer who is really pushing.
Who's not even vegan, by the way. He's a vegan influencer who's not vegan. He eats eggs and he talks about how he likes eating shellfish and seafood and things like that. And who knows what else? I mean, he can be completely full of it and just eat meat all the time.
The reason why this is relevant is because he's got such a large platform and a very, very large audience. Mm-hmm. And he's advocating for and pushing narratives that I believe are harmful. And one of them that he talked about recently was that he said, the dietary guidelines aren't correct. The dietary guidelines are appropriate. It's just that people are not following them. And he's quoted mm-hmm. some, you know, low quality studies that essentially are trying to gaslight people and gaslight the population into believing or thinking that, you know, you just haven't dieted hard enough. You haven't eaten enough serves of whole grains. You haven't eaten, your Mediterranean diet enough. But really, it's a very, very disingenuous position. And having treated patients with type 2 diabetes in my mm-hmm. clinic as a general practice doctor, and they are people do exactly what they tell you, especially the older people. And I think you'd know the same in your functional medicine practice. People have listened to these low fat, high carb, seed oil dietary message for the past 50 years, and they have developed type 2 diabetes, obesity, metabolic disease, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease as in part, a large part, because of they've followed these dietary guidelines. So to blame people that they haven't followed them, and that's why, you know, disease is still as prevalent, is completely disingenuous. It's essentially victim blaming. And what, I mean, you can just add it to the list of narratives that Simon is pushing that is simply not correct. And it's not leading us to a healthier position at all, collectively as a society.
Yeah. Well, it's also a pretty room temperature IQ sort of thought, because the thing is that even if only 9% of people are following the guidelines, the society at large has been influenced by the guidelines and has moved towards the guidelines. And that's what the consumption data shows. That we've been eating less red meat, less fat, less cholesterol, more fruits and vegetables, more heart healthy grains, more polyunsaturated heart healthy fats, and more sugar as well, because everything tastes disgusting now. And so you have to add sugar to everything. And so whether or not they're doing exactly what Simon Hill wants, they are moving in that direction. More people are eating more plant-based. More people are eating less meat, less red meat. Again, chicken has replaced a lot of the red meat that has come out, but less fat, less cholesterol. So they're moving towards the guidelines. They have been influenced by the guidelines for eating less of these so-called heart unhealthy things and more of the so-called heart healthy things. And our hearts have gotten worse. And we're taking statins and we're taking drugs all to lower cholesterol. And yet first-time heart attacks are still going up. So, you know, that it's not very intelligent. And I think the thing is, it's not honest, because these are the same tired sayings. It's the same arguments by the same people. I even got into it with Stan Efferding, who's just, I mean, the guy's a mouth breather. I mean, the guy's has only accomplished anything through rampant steroid abuse. And, and he admits it, you know, and the thing is, the guy was like 19, went to college, couldn't put on any muscle, couldn't do anything, found that he had that he wasn't making much testosterone. So he went on TRT as a 19-year-old and then said, hey, this is fun if I take 20 times as much as I should. And so his body was not geared up to actually be successful in any physical endeavor. And so any sort of physical accomplishment the man has made are not his own. I'm sorry, but they're not. And but he's been saying the same thing. This guy has something called a vertical diet where he's been telling people eat steak and eggs, steak and eggs, steak and eggs, steak and eggs, which is a major bodybuilder diet. It's a lot of steak and eggs. And this guy's been saying that for years. He's been doing that himself. And now he's using the exact same arguments that you have quoted from Simon Hill. He literally said that same thing to me the other day. And exact same things about, well, the age adjusted mortality rates and blah, blah, blah. Like, first of all, anytime you adjust anything, you're not using the true data. You've changed and altered the data. So anytime someone says, oh, I've used this age adjusted instantly, you know, it's not accurate. But, you know, he's using these exact same arguments. So I don't know if Stan's maybe got game changered or something like that, and is now going crazy vegan. I don't know, but people are listening, and they are following the guidelines, and they're going towards that. The problem is you eat the guidelines and you get sick and you feel like crap. All right, so let's see the people. Okay, so only 9% of people are following the guidelines. What's their health like? Right? Has anyone looked at that? Because 9% of Americans have type 2 diabetes. Is it that 9%? You know, and that accounts for 75% of the Medicare costs. So, you know, maybe that's not a good thing that as much as 9% of people are following the guidelines. It's probably a very bad thing, but everyone else has moved towards that. And that's a very bad thing. You know, like you say, you know, when I have patients, like they come to me and say, I've tried this, I've tried this, I've tried this, I've tried this, and nothing works. And you get the, you know, the victim blamers, like you say, Nodalski and Lane Norton, that just say like, oh, well, if you're in a calorie deficit, then you're just going to lose weight. And they're like, well, I'm not eating, and I'm still gaining weight. I'm almost not eating anything. And I had a guy who, you know, was basically eating nothing, and he was still putting on weight, and he lost weight initially, and then it plateaued off. And then he was like, started putting on weight. Anything the guy ate, he would just put on weight. He's like, what the hell is going on? Because you kill your metabolism. Yeah. Your body thinks you're in a famine and fast and starving. And so it slows down your metabolism. Less coming in, less going out. That's all there is to it. And so, you know, and so Nodalski and Lane Norton will say like, oh, if you're saying you're in a calorie deficit, but you're not losing weight, you're just a liar. No, you're just an idiot, and you haven't treated real patients.
Who's
like
obviously
doctor.
Very leptin resistant, and if he clearly has no understanding of the fact that these are profound hormonal shifts that are occurring and that are causing weight loss resistance.
Yeah. Well, but also, I mean, this is very hormones, very wrapped up in hormones, such as leptin, but also insulin. Insulin is the fat storage hormone. It does other things too, but it does store fat. We have type 1 diabetics who don't produce any insulin. They can't put on any fat. They waste away until they die. And then you have people that have insulinomas that secrete massive amounts of insulin. And it doesn't matter what they eat. They get enormously obese very quick. And so, you know, that is what insulin does. And so if you're eating 2,000 calories a day worth of high carbohydrate, high insulinogenic food, you are going to get a different response than you eat 2,000 calories of meat and fat, right? It's just two different things. You have completely different hormonal responses. But, you and I see these patients, and, you know, I put them on a high-fat meat-based diet, and I'm sure you've done the same thing too. Diabetes goes away. Autoimmune diseases go away. Blood pressure issues go away. Weight goes away. Leptin comes down. Insulin comes down. Blood sugar comes down and normalizes. And then the weight starts dropping off, and they start healing themselves from the inside out. Their thyroid starts improving. Testosterone levels increase. I had a 72-year-old man triple his testosterone, got to the level of a 25-year-old. And he said he was just bouncing off the walls. He just says like, oh, I just feel so good. I feel like a teenager again. So, you know, these are major, major, major recoveries that people are having. And this is not, these are not one-offs. These are not anecdotes. This is every single damn time that someone adopts these these lifestyle changes. And so, you know, a theory is only as good as what it's able to predict. And these people are saying, oh, calorie deficit, and you'll get where you want to go. Well, they did it and it didn't work. Liars. They're just liars. No, your idea was dumb and it needs to go away. But, you know, we say like, look, if you eat this exact way, these are going to be your exact results. We'll call it on you. I can see all your bloods. This is how your bloods are going to look in 3 months if you stick to this. And that's what happens. So, you know, it's just a simple matter of hubris and ignorance.
And let's get to another one of kind of Simon Hill's bad takes, which essentially is also a bad take of the entire preventative cardiology establishment, which is that you've had a patient that you've just described, Anthony. Everything is going in the right direction on a blood biomarker point of view, except ApoB. Mm. So ApoB is, you know, a marker of it's a cholesterol, it's an LDL type, it's a lipoprotein that kind of tags these lipoproteins. So the narrative is that to prevent atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which we've just spent, you know, an hour talking about, that we need to lower that number to an arbitrary 70, 80 US decimals per arbitrary, whatever the US unit is. In Australia, we use millimole. The point is that argument is used by both the centralized preventive cardiologists and guys like Simon Hill, who are saying that we should not eat any forms of animal-derived saturated fats. We should predominantly eat, you know, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated plant-derived oils. So to me, again, it doesn't make any sense if every biomarker is going in the right direction, yet in some patients, total cholesterol, LDL, ApoB goes up. So should we treat them with a statin for primary prevention or based on one number? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is too, how do statins treat LDL cholesterol? It stops and prevents your body from making large point LDL molecules. It doesn't even like get rid of like the SDLDL and the other sort of damaged LDL molecules, which might be a benefit to some people. But you know, this is just shifting the goalposts. You know, they lose on every single front. This has been a losing argument since the 1950s. And so every time something comes up, there's just a fudge factor. They just say, okay, well, no, it's just, there's this other thing. Oh, there's this other thing. Now there's this other thing. The fact of the matter is you go to the genesis of this. This was not brought about by any serious scientist. You know, we say there was Ansel Keys, but it wasn't Ansel Keys. It was the sugar companies paying Ansel Keys to say this. So this wasn't someone who said, hey, look, I think this is what this is, and doing that honestly. It was a sugar company is going, shit, there's research coming out showing a direct relationship between sugar consumption and heart disease. We need to cover this up. And so they paid off multiple professors, such as Ansel Keys and a number from Harvard, to falsify data and publish fraudulent studies to make it appear as if cholesterol caused heart disease, when it's much more likely to be sugar, and to exonerate sugar and say that it was safe. And one of those professors was named head of the USDA. He was the one who authored and published the USDA declaration saying that cholesterol caused heart disease, saturated fat increased cholesterol, stop eating both. This is not up for debate. Simon Hill even wrote about this in his book. This is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2016, the actual internal memos from the Sugar Research Foundation. So this is a fact. And Simon even knows this. And then he goes on to say, oh, yeah, you know, sugar companies blamed cholesterol. And I think that, you know, sugar is bad, but cholesterol is still bad too. And it's like, hold on a second. You know, you documented out how this was founded as a scam in the first place. And now you're trying to say that, yes, it was a scam and we shouldn't have taken the blame off sugar. Sugar's still bad, but cholesterol is still bad too. That makes no sense either. So the thing is they blame total cholesterol. That was wrong. It actually showed in the Framingham study actually showed an inverse relationship between total cholesterol and cardiovascular mortality rate, even though the AHA falsely reported it 2 years later as showing the opposite. And that's what I was taught in medical school. I don't know if you were taught the same, but they specifically talked about the Framingham study that more cholesterol equaled more cardiovascular mortality. And that's not what the data actually showed. The data showed an inverse relationship, a protective mechanism between cholesterol or protective association between total cholesterol and cardiovascular mortality rate. And then they said, okay, well, it's not total cholesterol. There's multiple different kinds of cholesterol. HDL is good. LDL is bad. So good cholesterol, bad cholesterol. So then it shifted over to LDL cholesterol. Okay. So they're doing that for a while. And then people realize, oh crap, there's over 100 different kinds of LDL cholesterol. And some of them are good. Maybe some of them are bad. And so now, you know, okay, SDLDL. Okay. How do you get SDLDL? Hyperglycemia, alcohol, seed oil. Like, ooh, okay, we actually want to protect those things. And I was like, oh, ApoB, and that now that's the problem. It's just nonsense. It was crap then, it's crap now. And they're just trying to shift and jump around. The thing is, we just have to stop engaging them. We just have to stop letting them enact these red herring arguments. It says, okay, well, this was crap from the beginning. It's crap now. And that's the end of it. Oh, but ApoB, no, we're not doing this anymore. Stop. It's done. We had ApoB in the 1800s. We had no heart disease then to speak of. All right. It's done. This is over now. The Journal of the American Medical Association published in 2020 a massive literature review with randomized controlled trials, meta-analyses of randomized controlled trials and others, you know, top tier level one evidence. And they found that there was no association between saturated fat intake and cardiovascular disease. None. None. So you can't prove causation from association. And so, you know, regardless of, you know, our colleague, Dr. Peter Attia, who says that, you know, it is proven, anybody who understands, you know, math and statistics knows that this is causative. There is no single causative study between showing causation between cholesterol and heart disease. None. There are associative studies, and that's it. We talked to a friend of ours, Nick Norwitz, who's PhD in biochemistry from Oxford, finishing his MD from Harvard, and worked with Dave Feldman on the lean mass hyperresponders, showing that people that have massively, well, to their eyes, massively elevated LDL cholesterol, I think it's right where it's supposed to be, they don't develop heart disease. These people have been, have very elevated LDL cholesterol for an average of 4.7 years and no progression in their atherosclerosis. In fact, the trend was to go down and reverse their atherosclerosis in comparison to the Miami Heart Study cohort, right? So it's just wrong. It's just false. I mentioned to Nick about Peter Attia and how there's no causative studies. He was saying, like, well, you know, sort of in this cascade of causation, you need to be sufficient and necessary, right? And that's what gets causation. So, okay, it's necessary, but is it? But it's not necessarily sufficient. I don't think it's both. You know, I don't think it's either. I don't think it has anything to do with heart disease. It was a con from the beginning. And so, you know, we have studies with 160,000 patients, 140,000 patients having myocardial infarctions in America, and literally half have low normal LDL cholesterol. Remission. So it's not even associated. It's not even, you know, necessary, and certainly not sufficient. So you can have low LDL and still get heart disease, heart attacks, strokes. And in fact, there are studies that show that there's an inverse relationship. So with saturated fat, especially, so that Journal of the American College of Cardiology paper showed no association, which shows that there's no causation, because you have to have an association to have causation. But they showed an inverse association between saturated fat intake and stroke rate. So the more saturated fat people are eating, the lower their stroke rate, and the less saturated fat they're eating, the higher their stroke rate. So it's not necessary or sufficient. This stuff is not related. So there's no sort of causation whatsoever. There are no studies that show causation. And the fact of the matter is, this is just, you know, I mean, we don't even need any of this. We know this was a con at the beginning. There was no evidence to support the cholesterol heart hypothesis in the beginning. And there's no evidence to support it now. There's a lot of evidence to the contrary. We've had the exact same numbers of familial hypercholesterolemia cases in the 1800s as we did today in the 17 and 16 and 15 and 14 and all the rest. We were eating more meat at the time. We had a lot of people that were eating a lot of meat, a lot of fat, and presumably would have had high ApoB, high LDL. And yet again, heart disease did not become a major killer until the 20th century. It doesn't matter what anybody says. We have very strong medical records and data and census data. We have death records. We have extremely detailed census data going back even to the mid 20th century. They had deaths by diseases. They had deaths across the country, major killers across the country. They had it in each state, in each major city, in each state, major cities across America. They had it differentiated between gender. They had it differentiated between ethnicity. They had it differentiated between location in cities. I mean, this is incredibly detailed census data, incredibly detailed medical data and mortality records and obituaries, extremely detailed. This stuff didn't exist in the 1800s. I'm sorry. And so, you know, you can't just say, oh, we just didn't notice it. That is a cop-out. And it's a complete and utter cop-out.
The reason why this is so important is because people are continuing to be prescribed medications like statins for primary prevention, which mm-hmm. there is so little really good quality longevity mortality data for. And it's really hinging on the premises of the people that we've mentioned, you know, Dr. Peter Attia, and he's referencing these cardiology kind of thought leaders or professors who think it's a good idea to lower ApoB to that of an infant. And if we get everyone's ApoB to an infantile level, then, you know, heart disease disappears. But it just doesn't make sense based on what we've just talked about. And the fact, the complete ignorance of this endothelial damage etiology of heart disease, which is clearly what is quite obviously, if you delve into this holistically, what is going on. And I don't think any of these cardiologists can describe the thrombotic hypothesis in any coherent way. They don't understand the exclusion zone water that's forming on the endothelial layer at all. And then to take a statin is actually a mitochondrial toxin. That is not my opinion. That is published literature, that there are multiple pathways by which HMGA CoA reductase, these essentially mycotoxins, are interfering with mitochondrial function. And if we go back to what I said earlier, which is that these chronic diseases are diseases of mitochondrial failure, it therefore becomes obvious that if you take long-term statin therapy, you might increase your risk of cognitive problems like Alzheimer's disease. And we have challenge and re-challenge trials, which show that cognitive outcomes worsened when you added a statin and then removed the statin in people with underlying mild cognitive impairment. So to see what Peter Attia and his colleagues are saying is, to me, grand scale iatrogenic harm, because it just doesn't make sense. And to add another facet onto this, one of Attia's mentors is Dr. Thomas Dayspring, who is, you know, a career lipidologist, and he's got a list of pharmaceutical kind of conflicts of interest and list of honoraria and affiliation with pharmaceutical industry, you know, as long as you're on. And it makes sense that if someone is only looking within this narrow beam of preventative cardiology, they're not looking at all these other outcomes, and they're having had, you know, financial conflicts of interest, that they're going to continue to recommend statin therapy to lower ApoB, even if someone's metabolically healthy, even with all these other lifestyle practices in place. So to me, it's baffling, but more than anything, it's harmful for people who are, you know, taking this advice and then getting sick.
Yeah. Well, it's also how can we trust how well can we trust the ApoB test in the first place? You know, because the ApoB it shows up on healthy cholesterol molecules as well. And so, you know, we're taking the good in with the bad, and we're saying it's all bad. So you can't actually do that. It's not a sufficient test. Even if it were in certain circumstances, damaging, harmful, and atherogenic, that test that we test for ApoB is inaccurate, because we see it on healthy cholesterol molecules as well. And so it's simply not a reasonable test to look for. You know, one thing that Dr. Attia said is that, oh, well, if you look at the familial hypercholesterolemia data, like, well, it's just clear. It's clear as day. You know, cholesterol goes up, heart disease goes up. Okay. Same numbers of familial hypercholesterolemia in the 1800s, and yet no, right? So again, so that doesn't make sense. But also, what Dr. David Diamond pointed out in some of his lectures was that there are studies that have actually shown that people with FH, familial hypercholesterolemia, that they are actually genetically predisposed to have clotting disorders, which goes exactly in, you know, the clot thickened side of things. You get damage and get clotting. And this is why aspirin is actually protective, is because you get damage, you get a clot, but it's not going to be as big of a clot if you have aspirin on board, right? And so they're more likely to have clotting disorders. You have people that have clotting disorders that are more likely to have strokes and other sorts of thrombus and that sort of etiology affecting their body. And so when you look at studies that separate out the two of people that just have the cholesterol part between, or and then separate out the ones that have the clotting and the high cholesterol, it's only the group that has high cholesterol and clotting that get the increased rates of heart disease in the early decades. And then after 50, it ends up matching the normal population. And so the high cholesterol group without the clotting disorder, they had exactly the same rates of heart disease as the rest of the population. This is very straightforward stuff. And so it was, oh my God, this proves everything. You're just not looking close enough. And, you know, and it doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit the observed phenomena, right? Which is that we weren't seeing these deaths in this numbers in the 1800s. Okay. So why are we seeing it now? Right. That cholesterol level was always there. Why wasn't it causing disease? Something else is happening. You know, Einstein did this too. You prove something mathematically. But then he would go and look for observations and he'd sort of look and say like, nope, that goes against what the observed phenomena must have been wrong, right? Because he clearly didn't know all the variables, clearly didn't know everything was going on. It's like, okay, well, we have to observe more and try to figure things out. You can't just say, ah, here's this idea and it fits this principle, never looking again. If it doesn't fit with experiment, if it doesn't fit with the observed phenomena, it's wrong. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter the letters behind your name. It doesn't matter where those letters came from. It's wrong. And so you have to have some humility here. You have to have some insight and introspection and understand that, you know, if these things don't agree with the world around you, the world isn't the one that's wrong. It's you.
Yeah. There's it's so much to say there, and you've really laid it out really eloquently, Anthony. So thank you. I think this has been a valuable discussion for people to try and conceptualize this idea of cholesterol and the causes of heart disease. And I'll just make the, you know, one final point that, you know, if we really understand what we're saying, the listener, is that anything that's disrupting that blood vessel health is going to lead to clotting. So looking after endothelial health is the prime strategy if we're trying to maintain or prevent the development of heart disease. And obviously maintaining insulin sensitivity, eating a lower carb diet does that, as well as practices that preserve that exclusion zone water on the inside lining of the endothelium. And that's where the ancestral practice, like grounding, the fact that, you know, ancestors were grounded, that built the exclusion zone in that endothelium. The fact that they're exposed to sunlight, they had infrared light from the sun, they're outside. So, you know, I think that having high total cholesterol, high ApoB in the context of insulin resistance, in the context of visceral fat, in the context of an indoor environment where you never get out in the sun, you never get ultraviolet A light, you never build nitric oxide, you never build that exclusion zone, that is when high ApoB and high total cholesterol and high LDL is going to be problematic. Because you're doing everything wrong. You're doing everything in the way that it wasn't supposed to be done ancestrally. So I don't want people to get the wrong message. What we're saying is that if you have a high ApoB, don't ignore it if you're doing everything wrong. But if you're doing everything right, if you're insulin sensitive, if you're physically active, if you're getting that morning sun, if you're grounded, if you're doing everything to promote endothelial health and you're living an ancestral type practice, you're doing those ancestral practices, then you shouldn't be taking a statin for primary prevention, because there's no evidence that it's going to help you and it's probably going to harm you.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is too is that even if you've had a heart attack, according to the statin company's own literature, and you know, no product is ever going to look rosier than in the study that the company who made it pays for. You know, so they pay for a study. It's going to look, that's as good as that product's ever going to look. And so in the statin company's own literature, if you've had a heart attack and you take statins every single day for the rest of your life and for at least 5 years, then you'll increase your life expectancy. So that's great. You'll increase your life expectancy, but only by 5 days, right? So that's their literature showing that this only increases by 5 days. And I've seen people try to lie and things like that and really mislead people, which I think is malpractice, where they say, oh, statins extend life by decades. That's a flat out lie. There is zero evidence of that. In fact, the statin company's own evidence shows that it's 5 days if you've had a heart attack. If you have not had a heart attack, it does not extend life. So really, what is the benefit that we're getting here? Some people that still prescribe statins but don't believe that it's helpful because of this, of the cholesterol lowering effect, think that there's some sort of anti-inflammatory sort of effect similar to aspirin that may be beneficial potentially in clotting, right? But this cholesterol lowering effects is not necessarily the benefit there. And how much benefit is there? It's not all that much unless you've had a heart attack and then it's 5 days, which is still not all that much. So again, cholesterol was never the problem in the first place. And I think that it behooves us to basically just throw that out and not engage anymore and say, it's like, well, we should take a statin because you want to lower your cholesterol. We never needed to lower our cholesterol. Cholesterol was never a thing. So why would you lower it? You know, that's where I stop with that, you know, and you can then go on to say, well, you know, the statin company's own data shows that it's really not doing too much for you, especially if you haven't had a heart attack. It's not doing anything for you if you haven't had a heart attack. And that perfectly falls in line with the fact that cholesterol is not the problem. I mean, if cholesterol were necessary and sufficient, if it were the cause, then if you remove that cause, the effect would go away, but it's not. We're lowering cholesterol. We're reducing saturated fat. We've reduced total cholesterol. We've been taking these statins and other medications to reduce our cholesterol. We're eating more fiber and grains to lower our cholesterol more and more and more and more and more. And yet first-time heart attacks are increasing in prevalence. So, you know, that's obviously not doing so well. So you do all these sorts of things and heart attacks continue. You have 50% of people getting heart attacks have low cholesterol, low, quote unquote, low LDL cholesterol, probably lower than I would say that you want them. There was one study that followed up 160,000 patients for 3 years. The ones that, of course, because they're told to lower your cholesterol even more, lower it. And so the people that kept their cholesterol low or lowered it from high, they were twice as likely to have died in those 3 years of follow-up. So why are we doing this again? And so if there's no sort of connection, you know, there's no justification to treat that, right? And it was predicated on a lie. So we need to throw that out immediately in any case. And so, you know, if we're reducing cholesterol, and they keep saying, if you keep having heart attacks, you can keep lowering your cholesterol. There is no bottom number on your cholesterol, I bet, because you're the one selling us the drugs to do that. And so I'm sure you're more than happy for us to, you know, to take these drugs into an early grave. And so, oh, you lower your cholesterol and you have a heart attack. Okay, lower it more, have another heart attack. Lower it more, have a heart attack. At what point are you going to realize it's not the damn cholesterol? And that you're spinning your wheels and you're not addressing the fundamental root cause and you're likely hurting yourself.
Yeah. On that note, Anthony, thank you for a very, very in-depth discussion on the causes of heart disease. And I hope the listeners can take this away and really think about how they can best optimize their health and prevent heart disease based on what you've discussed. So, and I'll make one last point, which is I'm extremely excited to announce that in April we will be doing a live event in Melbourne, Australia, in Victoria, on the 21st. It's a Sunday. We have booked out 2075 Reed Street, which is an amazing venue in North Fitzroy. So, Anthony, you're going to be speaking there. I'm going to be speaking there. Dr. Pran Yoganathan, Dr. Jalal Khan, Charlie Arnott, Natalie West. We have an amazing lineup of speakers, and we're going to be delivering this type of discourse for people live in person. So just wanted to let everyone know that, and to buy a ticket to see Anthony and see me and see everyone speak live in person. So yeah, thank you, Anthony, for coming on. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and having this discussion. I think it's very, very valuable. So we will talk again soon. So thanks again.
Not a problem. Thank you, man. And looking forward to seeing you in April, and looking forward to seeing everyone else who's able to make it. It should be a very good event. Last year was awesome. And so this year will be great, I'm sure, as well.
Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you, and see you next time.